Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, Rome.
Coming up on the programme, after a recent damning report from Brussels, will Turkey ever get into the EU? We get analysis from the Belgian capital on what Turkey has to do to join the European party, and we also hear how Turks feel about jumping through EU hoops.
They, in fact, do not want us, because culture, our religion, living style.
And we hear from France, where it's become so expensive to get an apartment anywhere in town that thousands are living in campsites.
There are more and more people living here. Maybe they were less visible before, but now it's pretty obvious that most people living here have no other option.
Welcome to Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's international broadcasters. I'm Richard Walker. But first, Turkey's chances of joining the EU club. This is one of the most divisive issues in European political life. So if it were to become a member, would Turkey become more European, or would, as some Western Europeans fear, Europe become Muslimified? The European Commission released a much-talked-about report on Turkey's accession progress this week, and it didn't make for bedtime reading for Ankara. Turkey was attacked on its human rights, religious freedoms, and its attitude towards the divided island of Cyprus. There wasn't a call for a suspension of talks, but the report's bound to fuel speculation that Turkey's whole bid is going off the rails. Dorian Jones in Istanbul explains why this report set the Turkish government adrift somewhere on the Dardanelles Straits.
A Turkish news bulletin announcing the publication of the EU progress report. The eyes of the nation were on Brussels as it was released, but it was not good news for the country. Ankara was criticized for lack of progress, regardless of whether it was freedom of expression, religious rights, or Cyprus. But Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül tried to put a positive spin on its contents.
Biz üstümüze düşenleri yapmamız gerekir.
Certainly it talks about the successes and shortcomings that Turkey is experiencing. We must do what is required of us and we'll correct the problems stemming from implementation. But our partner must support us.
Such optimism was based on the belief that it could have been a lot worse. The Commission's report stopped short of making any recommendations for sanctions. Brussels seemed anxious to give Ankara more time to make reforms before next month's EU summit. The Turkish Prime Minister, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, this week met with NGOs to discuss the reform of the controversial Article 301, a key demand in the EU report. The law criminalizes statements against Turkishness and has led to the prosecution of numerous writers, including Nobel laureate Orhan Pamuk. But the ruling AK party, which is mindful of general elections due next year, is increasingly concerned about public opinion. Many Turks, like student Ayşe Gönül, feel that Brussels is looking for excuses to keep Turkey out of the EU.
They, in fact, do not want us, because culture, our religion, living style, it's all about us. This shows prejudice to our country and to our culture. But I believe that Turkey does not need the European Union to be a powerful or a strong country.
Last month, nationalists protested after the lower house of the French parliament voted to criminalize the denial of the genocide against Armenians in Turkey 90 years ago. Nationalism is on the rise here in Turkey, fueled by growing anti-European sentiments. According to the latest opinion polls, support for the EU has plummeted, with only a third of the population now supporting the country's membership bid.
Bütün konuşmalarda aynı tavrınızı sürdürüyorsunuz.
We will not take any unilateral steps. We are also expecting the European Union to fulfil its commitments, the compromise with the initiative of one side.
This week, parliamentarians discussed laws aimed at giving greater freedom to the country's Christian minority, another demand in the EU's report. But the opposition is refusing to support the reform, and the government is reluctant to proceed without a consensus, fearing it will be accused of selling out to Brussels. It's that fear which is also making it difficult to progress on the thorniest question of all, the divided island of Cyprus. The EU is demanding Turkey honours its commitment under the Ankara Protocol to open its ports to Greek Cypriot ships. But the Turkish Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül says the EU must also honour its commitment to lift an economic embargo against the Turkish side of the island.
We will not open this unilaterally, okay? We are also expecting European Union to fulfill its commitments. The compromise cannot happen with the initiative of one side.
But the lifting of the embargo is being blocked by the Greek Cypriots. Finland, which holds the EU presidency, is working hard to find a compromise before next month's EU summit. But some are now questioning whether such compromises with Europe are in Turkey's best interests. One of those people is Aman Kulolu. He's the head of the Turkish think tank Strategic. He says Turkey should look beyond Europe.
Instead of the participation of the European Union, Turkey can continue their position, their relation with the European countries, special relationship. And also Turkey can continue and create and increase their relation between Russia, China and the neighboring countries and the United States also. Turkey has been living 83 years as a republic without European Union, and Turkey can live in the future also without European Union.
Until recently, the Turkish government dismissed the idea of simply having a special partnership with the EU. Full membership of the bloc was the only option under consideration. But times are changing in Turkey. Many believe the question of Turkey's membership bid will be settled by midnight negotiations on the eve of next month's EU summit. But more and more Turks are asking whether it's really worth the effort. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
And we'll come back to Turkey's EU membership bid a little later with analysis from Brussels. First, let's have a look at what imminent EU membership means for Romania. Cash, for one thing. My colleague Julian Murasan from Radio Romania International reports on Romania milking the euro cash cow and what the country will be bringing to the EU.
Romania will be the seventh biggest country of the EU, with a population of almost 22 million. It is estimated that up to 2 million Romanians are already working in the EU member states, and they're doing well. Onno Simons, the deputy head of the European Commission delegation in Romania, regards Romanians not as a threat to Europe, but one of its main assets.
It's going to be a lot of hard-working people. That's good, because we do need a lot of people, hard workers, skilled workers, to keep Europe competitive. Also, a market of 23 million consumers, and I can say a great number of euro enthusiasts, because not in every member state of the European Union is the regard for the European Union as high as in Romania.
Romania has now a European commissioner. Deputy Integration Minister Leonard Orban will take over from Jan Figel, who was in charge of education, training, culture and multilingualism. French Ambassador to Bucharest Hervé Bolo underlined the importance of this portfolio and warned against the absence of knowledge and debate about Europe, which was felt when the European draft constitution was rejected in France and the Netherlands.
The portfolio for education, training, culture and multilingualism is extremely important in the European Union. We count on Romania to bring into schools, universities and the media genuine education about Europe.
Another positive thing that Romania brings to the Union is a good economic growth rate. The IT industry is one of Romania's most dynamic. And yet, Cristian Preda, a Secretary of State with the Romanian Foreign Ministry, places his bet on the future of Romanian agriculture, which has been neglected so far.
Our agriculture has not grown very much in the last 16 years. But I think it will be very interesting to see in a few years from now that agriculture and not the IT industry might bring something useful to Europe.
So there's many good things that Romania can bring into Europe, but there's also at least one really bad thing, and that is corruption. Transparency International has just published its Corruption Perceptions Index. In January 2007, Romania will be the most corrupt country in the European Union.
Just let go and let me love you every way that I can. That's Turkey's triumphant 2003 Eurovision Song Contest tune by Sertab Erener. It was a dream come true for Sertab, maybe not for listeners. But after this week, that might be the closest Turkey ever gets to being at the heart of Europe. The European Commission's criticised Turkey's efforts at reform and the progress it's made towards shaping up for possible EU membership. Our brain in Brussels, Stephen Castle, told me there was some good news for Turkey from the Commission's report, just not that much.
Well, the European Commission was very careful to stress that Turkey is making reforms. The whole process of change internally hasn't ended. But it did say very clearly that these reforms are just not going quickly enough. Olli Rehn, the enlargement commissioner, entertained the media in his press conference by saying that the whole process of enlargement wasn't like a high-speed train, not like a TGV or a Eurostar. It was more like the Orient Express, he said. The slight problem with that is that I think most people think, when they think of the Orient Express, think of the Agatha Christie movie where a group gangs up on one of the passengers
and kills
does
them.
Away with them. So I think Turkey will just have to hope that it doesn't find itself in that position.
The big problem, of course, with Turkey is still its attitude towards Cyprus, in the eyes of the Commission at least, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think this is the key point, because with all the internal reforms, the questions of the judiciary, of freedom of expression, etc., Turkey will have some time really to change those laws. It's got 10 to 15 years before it would ever actually join the European Union. The question of Cyprus, however, is much more pressing, because the Turks have an end-of-the-year deadline by which they should open up their ports to Cypriot shipping. And if they don't do that, then there are going to be repercussions for these talks. At least some of the Turkish membership negotiations are going to be suspended.
Now, what about Turkey's laws that make it a criminal offence to criticise Turkey? We've had a couple of high-profile cases recently. Orhan Pamuk, the celebrated writer who was prosecuted for mentioning the Armenian genocide. Those laws are sensitive in the eyes of the Commission, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, they featured quite prominently in the progress report that we got. The rather infamous Article 301 of the Turkish Constitution, which was the one that was used against Orhan Pamuk, is on the statute book. Interestingly, just before the report was released, the Turkish Prime Minister, Mr. Erdogan, gave us a very strong hint that he was open to changing this law, and that was a positive sign. However, Olli Rehn, the EU Enlargement Commissioner, when he gave his press conference, made the point that actually he'd been calling for change on this particular issue for at least 2 years.
Do you get the feeling that Turks are getting tired of all the EU hoops they're being asked to jump through? How many ordinary Turks are actually eager to join the EU now?
Well, I think this is you put your finger on quite a significant problem. We know that in many countries in Western Europe, enthusiasm for Turkish membership of the EU is declining. But what is quite alarming from the perspective of those who do want Turkey to join is the drop in support inside the Turkish state itself. And there was a recent opinion poll that showed that whereas support for the US and for the EU was declining in Turkey, support for Iran was rising. And according to some opinion polls, the level of support for EU membership is down to around about a third. I mean, it used to be at least double that.
As Turkey chews over what more it needs to do to win EU membership, the Turkish army's flexing its muscles in domestic politics. The Prime Minister's in a tricky situation because conservative Muslims form the backbone of his support. But the Turkish army defends the separation of state and religion, something that might win over sceptics in the EU. Radio Netherlands Europe editor Johan Housinger told me the army's a cornerstone of what Europeans want to see plenty of: religion in its right place, far away from government.
First of all, they were one of the creators, one of the founders of this secular state, together, of course, with the Mr. Kemal Atatürk, the real founder. And they've always maintained that role of guarding this secular state, meaning there is a secular state, a strict division between the secular state and religion, which is something on an individual base, but not to base your collective identity on. So that means that collective identity means Turkish citizenship. Turkish nationalism. And religion is something for everybody to do in his own time on a very individual base.
Do you think on that basis then, are the fears that the Muslim influence from Turkey, were it to join the EU, are unfounded?
I think these fears are indeed not justified, because you cannot compare Turkey to many other states in the Middle East. Indeed, there is a very strict separation. All these peoples, a lot of them have a very strong belief, but still they're very much attached to this secular state as well.
And it seems that is enshrined in the fact that the military backs up that secular state.
Yes, that is true. The army still feels like it has the role, and it has to maintain the role of guarding this secular state. You could say it sometimes is even abused by the army. For instance, by the new, fairly hawkish chief of staff, General Büyükanıt, who is using this guarding role to lash out at the government of Prime Minister Erdoğan, which has its roots in Islam, but is very secular as well.
Are there not people at the very top layer of government who seek to redefine secularism at every opportunity? Are the personality and ideology of Atatürk, our founder, and the very principles of his republic not under attack? Can you say there's no such thing in Turkey? If you cannot, then there is a threat from reactionary forces here, and every measure must be taken against this.
Maybe for Western European people it's fairly bizarre to hear a general warning a government for possible changes in the constitution, because that was what he was up to. The speaker in the house has speculated on possibly redefining the word secularism. And the background of that is that next year there will be elections, and next year they will have to deliver a new president. And the president, traditionally in Turkey, is also one of the main guards over this secular state. Now, Mr. Erdoğan, who has a wife who wears the headscarf which is forbidden to wear in public buildings and schools and universities in Turkey because of this very strict separation.
If we have the wife of the Prime Minister wearing a headscarf, then it sets a precedent for pretty much everybody else.
Yes, it's this symbol, a president with a wife wearing a headscarf in the presidential palace, that is just too much for the army. That is such a strong symbol of Islam mixing and meddling with the secular state, and with the strongest symbol of the secular state being the president. In their eyes, it's even illegitimate.
That's Opera Opera, Turkey's entry to the 1983 Eurovision Song Contest by Setin Alp and the Shortwave, which came last. And 23 years on, Turkey's still not feeling the love from Europe. Now, from Brussels business, we swing south towards Paris and beyond, where more and more French people are resorting to living all year round in campsites. People on low incomes are on waiting lists for years before they're offered low-cost public housing in France. But in recent years, rents in the private sector have skyrocketed, and landlords are expecting a long list of guarantees from tenants before they'll hand over the keys. You might think living on a campsite is an extreme option, but more than 100,000 people have taken it. Radio France International went to meet some of them in the Essonne area, 50 kilometres south of Paris.
The Camping des Aubins is where 36-year-old Reynald, his girlfriend Nadege, and his 8-year-old child live year-round. The camping ground is in the woods, there's a river running alongside, and it's completely fenced off, so it's convenient for children. It's chilly outside, but the camping site is busy.
There are lots of people in serious debt living here. So it's here, we're sleeping in the street. Camping is not free, but they don't ask for a 3-month deposit, no payslips, and all the rest of it. There are more and more people living here. Maybe they were less visible before, but now it's pretty obvious that most people living here have no other option.
I'm Angélique from the far end of the camping site. I'm in the process of divorcing. The procedure's been going on there for 14 years, and I owe a lot of money to my lawyers. I work, but for temping agencies. I don't have a full-time job, and that's not good enough for landlords. I had very little money and nowhere to go, so I considered the camping ground option. At first, I thought it'd be temporary, that I'd stay here for a couple of months. But it's my fourth year here already.
59-year-old Angélique burst into tears in the middle of the interview, but Rinald and Nadège were there to comfort her.
No one locks the doors here. We all know each other. We respect each other. It's not about it being peace and love. We respect each other.
Other than living in a trailer or in a caravan, people at the Camping des Aubins have one more thing in common. They are all trying to recover from their wounds. Jacques is an Elvis Presley fan. He chose to live here because he knew that 640 euros a month would not get him very far. That's a month's rent for a 20 square meter flat in Paris. He survived his depression thanks to his neighbors.
I was ill, I was paralyzed, then I divorced. I could no longer work as a cook because I suffered memory loss. I couldn't afford living in a flat. Too expensive. I was depressed when I arrived here, but that's behind me now. I'm no longer on prescription medication. We're like a family here. We always help each other out. See, that's my neighbor's house. He's keen on fishing. You want us to pay him a visit?
Jacques's neighbor Michel arrived 2 years ago. He's a former electrician but had to stop. He lost a lung because of an asbestos-related disease he caught on construction site. He is quite pleased with the way he has arranged his 30-square-meter trailer.
I've got a fridge, a freezer, an electric oven, an old-style dresser, a small dining room. Behind us there's the living room with a small stereo for the wife's music, toilets and a shower. A small kitchen in the corner there, you see, there's a sink. And yes, the fish. It's for my neighbour. He's the one who cooks it.
It's believed that between 75,000 and 150,000 people live in camping sites year-round in France. It is illegal, but the authorities are turning a blind eye because they have nothing better to offer. Joey Sacco is head of an organization called ALEM. He says the government should give him and his friends more rights.
One does not have the right to housing allowance in mobile housing.
What about your official address? Do you have one?
No, not in most cases. Most camping sites don't allow you to use the address administratively because, in fact, it's illegal for them to have people living on the camping site all year round.
Without an official address, it's difficult to open a bank account, register to vote, or enroll children in schools. Members of Parliament are considering rewriting the law, but not in the direction Joy Sacco would like them to. If an amendment put forward by the ruling UMP party goes through, people living in caravans and trailers will have one more hurdle. They'll no longer be exempt from the so-called local occupancy tax. Paris, Nick Champeau, RFI.
Now, a recent study revealed a massive increase in the number of overseas students enrolling at universities in Britain. In fact, the number has more than doubled since the mid-1990s. So what's led to this huge rise and what impact is it having on university education in the UK? Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby has been finding out.
I'm at the London School of Economics in the centre of the British capital. Here, a whopping 40% of students are from outside the EU. In fact, they have students from 140 countries around the world. While the LSE has a higher percentage of overseas students than any other British university, their presence is being felt across the UK.
Overseas students from outside the UK have been coming to Britain for a long period from a variety of parts of the world. The largest single area of recruitment are the Far East, with China having grown massively in the last 5 or 6 years.
Says Professor Geoffrey Crossick of Universities UK, the body which represents British universities. He headed a team which recently brought out a report saying the number of overseas students in the UK has more than doubled in the last decade. In 2005, there were 210,000 non-EU international students in Britain. What is it that brings them here?
I think we need to look at two factors. One is why students are travelling abroad for education generally, and secondly, why they're coming to the UK. There's been an enormous increase in what we call transnational education. Students are moving around the world in much larger numbers than ever before for their education. The reason why they're coming to the UK in ever-increasing numbers is because of the very high quality of education at UK universities. When we talk about postgraduate students and research students, then it's the international research quality of UK universities that is so important. We are, by all measures, second only to the United States in the quality of research done in British universities.
Just down the street from the offices of Universities UK is the University of London, where Ronald Barnett is Professor of Higher Education. He offers further explanations for the boom.
Universities in the UK are fortunate in that their primary language of instruction is English, which is fast becoming the international language of commerce and business and professional life. There are other reasons as well. UK does have an international reputation for fairness and justice and openness.
Whatever the reasons, the growth in overseas students has not been accidental. Professor Krusik of Universities UK.
There was a time once when it was done, when the recruitment happened almost by chance. That long ago changed. For the last 10 to 15 years, UK universities, the same as those in many other parts of the world, have been actively recruiting students for a variety of reasons. And this has been added to by the Prime Minister's initiative, because the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, has taken a strong interest in the growth of overseas recruitment, seeing it as beneficial in many ways to the UK universities and the UK in general.
Indeed, some believe British universities have become financially reliant on overseas students. Higher education expert Ronald Barnett outlines just how important they are.
It certainly is worth several hundreds of millions of pounds to the higher education sector as a whole. Many institutions will be looking to have recruitment of international students running around 20% or so of overall student numbers, which, to put it in financial terms, represents a considerable income flow to institutions.
But what about the students themselves? What's their experience of studying in the UK? Back at the London School of Economics, I spoke to Sarwat and Metash, who are from Bangladesh.
I think, you know, the UK education system is really fascinating, and I've always had this dream of getting education abroad. So I did my undergrad here, that's why I'm doing my master's right now. And I think it's you've got a lot to learn from, basically. So.
And yourself, Sarwat?
I've come from Bangladesh. My master's is from Bangladesh. I'm doing my second master's here. But London School of Economics is the second in social science in the world. So I always wanted to study here, so I came.
And how has the experience been of studying here in the UK?
Fascinating so far, yeah. Really good, really good.
And what about the fees? How do the fees compare for overseas students compared to, say, EU students?
Yeah, I think, you know, for master's level, more or less, the fees are the same. But for undergrad, it was a rip-off because I was paying 10 times more than the EU or the local students. So, but the master's level, I think it sort of balances out.
I don't have much experience of the undergrad, but for postgrad, I think there is a good £4,000 difference between, because I'm paying 12,500 and a EU student will pay around about 8,000. So that's still quite a lot, because we are getting the same education. They're not getting any less.
Is there any downside to studying in the UK for overseas students? Anything negative?
Not so far, specifically in LSE, which is specifically an institution which is full of overseas students. I have found the environment very friendly to all the non-English speakers. There are learning centers and helpful. The support service is really good. So I haven't faced any difficulties here. I have found it rather accommodating.
And how is it studying somewhere that is so cosmopolitan? I read, for example, that there are students here from 140 countries.
It's really diverse. I mean, you get to see people from all different walks of life, and it's a very good experience.
As much as we are learning, actually more we are learning from the other students, we are also always chatting up about their own countries, their own experiences. So we learn a lot from there. Being a cosmopolitan is our great advantage, I think.
But what about the idea of UK universities themselves exporting their know-how overseas? In a pioneering move, the University of Nottingham has opened a campus in the Chinese city of Ningbo. Given Britain's strong international reputation in higher education, is this the way forward? Professor Geoffrey Crossick says it's too early to say.
I think that an increasing number of universities in the UK will seek to provide their education abroad as an alternative to drawing the students here. The reason for that is that there is a burgeoning market that we've talked about. Some of those students will always prefer to come to the UK. A good proportion of others would like to receive a UK degree and a UK quality of education, but do not have the resources or the desire to travel across the world to receive it. I think it's a good idea for UK universities to make their education available. Whether that is by establishing their own campuses remains to be seen, but a lot of universities are forming relationships with institutions in other countries and delivering their degrees through them. I suspect the expansion of that will be more common than actually establishing new campuses.
Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby with that report. Well, that's all we've got time for today. This programme is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Richard Walker and thanks very much for listening. To stare at the empty skies. I thought it was over and we passed all that. Hope it understood fast. Back to frame number one. Come on now, now. I wanna show you all again what it would be like. Just let go and let me love you. Just like I should. I know what you're thinking. Good now.